I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter at TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop us a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. That's mail@tellsomebody.us. I'd love to hear from you. Huge thanks to all the KKFI and Tell Somebody supporters who called in with a pledge last week. This might have been the best ever for this show. And thanks to investigative journalist Greg Pallas for helping out on the show. And remember, this really is your community radio station, so thank yourselves. And whether or not you made a pledge last week, think about getting involved with your station and help us spread the word to future new listeners. Look for links to past editions of this show and links and information about the shows at tellsomebody.us. A couple of quick notes. Two organizations that anybody and any group hoping to really accomplish almost any kind of positive change should get involved with are Friends of Community Media and KC Move to Amend. Look for them on Facebook, Friends of Community Media and KC Move to Amend. The Care of Poor People Incorporated, or COP Inc. Survival 13 event for the homeless is coming up on November 30th. Keep an eye on www.coppinc.com for more info and stay tuned to Tell Somebody. COP Inc. Director and Founder Richard Tripp will be returning to the show in the next few weeks to talk about how you can help. Kansas Advocates for Better Care, or KABC, is a nonprofit organization advocating for over 90,000 Kansans who require long-term care. KABC is having a Stand By Me benefit event this Sunday, including a 2013 KABC Caring Award presentation to Lawrence newspaper journalist Dave Ranney. That's this Sunday, October 20th, 2013, 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. at Maselli's, 1031 New Hampshire in Lawrence, Kansas. More information at www.kabc.org. On with the show. On the September 26, 2013 edition of Tell Somebody, we talked to Jeffrey Feinberg, Research Director for the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, about public perceptions and understanding of climate change. The very next day, the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the leading international body for the assessment of climate change, released a report in Stockholm, the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report, or AR5. This morning we're going to talk to Professor Michael J. Prather, who was in Stockholm on September 27th and is one of the authors of parts of the AR5. Give a listen. I'm on the phone now with Professor Michael J. Prather, Professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Professor Prather, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Tom, pleased to join you.
Very glad to have you. So, we've heard a fair amount of buzz about a report from the IPCC issued in, I believe, a meeting in Stockholm. Just for starters, can you just tell us what the IPCC is?
Certainly. The IPCC sounds like a mysterious group that comes out of somewhere that no one wants to know about. But it was actually put together by the governments a little over 20 years ago because of the need for an objective single voice. The governments were beginning their issue about negotiating for climate change and to reduce future climate change, and they decided and planned ahead that they needed a single objective voice that gave them what they regard as the key, the best scientific information upon which to make decisions. The IPCC doesn't say what decisions, it was trying to give you a single voice. If you don't do that, they learned from earlier lessons on the ozone. When they're setting up for the ozone treaty, they originally had different governments and different groups doing assessments, and they all got slightly different answers. Currently, if you take climate change, there are thousands of publishing scientists on it, and each one has their own voice. And so everyone will then say, oh, I have a new scientific paper, and my results are slightly different, which is true. So the purpose of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is IPCC, is to develop common ground. I mean, I don't think this word's used very often. People keep saying it's a consensus. It's really common ground. If you gather 100 scientists, 200, 300 scientists, they will all have different views. And the goal of this is to get them to agree on what is common ground for what we understand about the science, what we can predict and what we cannot about climate change. And so the government set it up, and every 6 years or so, they declare they want new information, and they turn a bunch of scientists loose and leave them alone for 4 years, a dangerous thing. And then at the end of the 4 years, the scientists come back with this assessment, which then the governments go through the summary of it, word by word, in a four-day plenary, which I just came back from in Stockholm, where the scientists gave them a first draft and the government started working on it and trying to say what it meant to them and could the scientists express it in English. So the process begins by turning the scientists loose, leaving them alone, and then the governments come back and say, do you really mean that? And so what comes out of that Stockholm plenary is a short summary, well, short and intense. It's about 15 to 20 pages, and you've read it. It's quite terse, right, Tom?
Indeed.
And it's sort of saying, from all the science of the last 6 years, how do we understand climate change? And what is our best understanding? What are the options for the future? What does the future look like? And so on. So this tries to put together, from the several hundreds of scientists involved, what they view as agreed upon common ground. It doesn't include everybody's papers. There's still disagreement in the science community going on about bits and pieces of this all over the place. This happens. This is normal. But this one is to try to put a single view, at least to what we can all agree on.
Okay. Now, I hope as we go on, you can help me through those 20 or so pages. But just what we've heard in the media, as casually listening, I've got some headlines here from thinkprogress.org posting on how not to write an IPCC headline. Warming slowdown seen as emissions rise to record. That's a Business Week headline. The National Post says global warming has slowed in the last 15 years despite record greenhouse gas levels, scientists say. Climate change reports, quote, temperature hiatus, unquote, fuels skeptics, CBC. Fox News says U.S. climate change report dismisses slowdown in global warming. And the Daily Mail says, it's not as bad as we thought, but global warming is still a disaster, warn UN experts.
That's a great one.
Still a disaster, but not as bad as we thought.
Oh.
What's your headline on what's in this report, and what's your reaction to the headlines?
Okay. The headlines have been picking on the biggest single thing that has, I will say, vexed, made us scientists curious, and everybody's been digging into it to try and understand, is it statistically significant? Do we believe that? So what has happened? So let's describe fairly what's happened. state average on temperatures, which you need to do for, this is climate. So weather has highly variable, year to year varies a lot. You've seen that. You know you have cold winters and warm winters and summers and so on. So you need to basically average over 10 years to get a reliable climate. And so what happens is if you take 10-year averages, every decade is still warming. Now, it's the last 10 years of record that we had for this assessment, which was 2012, was the most recent data point that was actually put into the assessment. And so if you take the 10 years before that, they are warmer than any 10 years that we've seen in the last 150 years. So it is still a hot planet. What happened in the last 15 years or so was the rate of warming dropped. And it is not what the models predicted, that's true, okay? And so it's still warm, but it warmed more slowly. And so that did cause the scientists consternation because they were trying to understand. Everybody's trying to model and understand and put the pieces together in a coherent picture, and this one caused everybody to sort of wake up. On the other hand, everything else we looked at, whether it's mountain glaciers retreating, whether it's sea ice extent, is still on the track to a warmer and hotter world, much hotter world. And so this one thing about global mean temperature has people very concerned and worried both scientifically, and then, of course, it makes a great headline. And there was a lot of work done to decide whether or not this 15-year period has happened in the past. And the answer was if you went through random 15-year periods, you might get something like this, but it was at the edge of likelihood, but it was still possible. And then the others, did the models produce this for random 15-year periods? And they somewhat did. But again, I think we're missing something in the forcing. People make the argument that means we don't know how to predict it, and the favorite one is that because the warming was less, even though, quote, greenhouse gas concentrations were at their peak, which should drive warming, means that the future predictions are all wrong and they need to be reduced. And that would be okay, except that for the three decades before that, using the greenhouse gases, which were increasing dramatically every year, using the models, we got exactly the right change in temperature. And so for three decades, the models and the physics and everything we put in were perfectly correct. And for this last 10-15 year period, it's a little slow. Okay. And so I think this has created the scientifically great fun because people are excited about what does it mean. And, you know, the greatest achievement for a scientist would be to write a paper explaining it. And we're starting to get some of those now.
Yeah. Bill Moyer's website posted a piece that they say originally appeared at Mother Jones called Four Climate Myths You'll Be Hearing This Week. And I think you've addressed this first one to some extent at least. Myth number one, global warming has stopped. And they quote, possibly the strongest articulation yet of the mean came from Republican Representative David McKinley of West Virginia, who said last week that there has been almost no increase in temperature in the last 40 years. And I'm not sure where he gets that, in the wake of the buzz about this AR-5. But
right. I mean, one of the main figures in that report, the very opening one, at least, shows the global mean temperature on the 10-year averages. And you can see the stair step going straight up, including the most recent 10 years. And so the idea that it hasn't changed in 40 years, that's been the period of most rapid warming, and it's been documented by everybody who measures surface temperature and tries to estimate it. I was even put together, there are three independent scientific groups, and a fourth group joined them. It was, somebody up in Berkeley who was not a climate scientist at all, but who got money from some industry firm or whatever to redo the analysis, and he put it all together and said, yep, I agree with what everybody else has been getting. And so the warming over the last 40 years is dominant. It's really quite impressive. As a matter of fact, that's one of the more compelling reasons why the last 10 years where it slowed a bit has not suddenly have everybody jumping, except they're looking for what that cause is, okay? They think there is a cause, and everybody's trying to pull together the pieces of it. The IPCC gave three or four possible examples. Each of one could be part of it, okay? But they didn't solve it. They didn't say we understand it entirely, and I don't think we do understand that slowdown.
But let's be as clear as possible. Whatever the cause of that slowdown, there is a very strong consensus among climate scientists that there is significant warming and that it a good part of it is caused by humans. Is that
correct? As I said, if it were only the last 15 years that we had to judge on, we'd be, well, there's still warming, but we wouldn't be as excited about necessarily. But the essence is, if we, how can I describe, there is a difference between the climate wanders around, it has its own natural variability. So there's climate variability, which can be natural, and it's built in the system. It's like weather. Okay, weather variability, you know, is storm fronts and tornadoes and whatever. They're highly variable. They're not necessarily predictable until you get near one. The climate has its problems, too, like El Niños or big Arctic warmings or not, tend to be sort of a climate variability, which are not predictable 10 years in advance. And so climate has its own wanderings. What's happened since 1960 is that the forcing we do by adding greenhouse gases has risen way above what would be the variability range. And that's what effectively happened is that climate, we've been forcing climate by adding greenhouse gases since 1800, but it's been small, and defining it relative to the variability we see out there is difficult. Since 1960-70, the forcing we've been doing is much larger, and the climate signal is actually predictable by most of the climate models on a decadal scale. And so that's why with 3 or 4 decades of evidence that we are now way outside the natural variability option, then we now have clear evidence that it's our forcing of greenhouse gases doing it. And there's been a brand new paper out in, I think it was Nature Geoscience, by some of our colleagues in Hawaii, who looked at, just last week, looked at the range of variability and when the range of variability is predicted to be outside the range of what we've seen over the last 30 years. And they're looking at, typically they're making estimates for much of the country of being by 2050 or 2060, the whole range, highs and lows and the median, will be well outside the high range that we have now. And so that's sort of an example of climate shift, is when you think of, we have 10, 20 years of highs and lows, we look at them, you know, you have hot summers and cold summers and everything else, you put them all together, and then you say, are those statistics changing? Because those statistics are what you plant by, or what you farm by, what you plan on for heating and energy. Those are the important statistics we live with every day. Okay, and we need to know whether those statistics are shifting, and almost all the climate models show they are. And the real question will be is, when are they so far beyond that we can say even the average day, even the coldest day, you know, in 2060 is warmer than the hottest day now?
Wow.
That's what people are looking at, and that's what people are sort of expecting, that this is going to happen in many places in the U.S. probably by, you know, 2060, 2050.
Wow. This is all just a little overwhelming. Before we get into this dense 20 pages, I wonder if we could go through the other 3 myths in this Mother Jones story and get you to respond to them. Myth number 2, Arctic sea ice is recovering. One of the most dramatic indicators of global warming was last summer's record low in the extent of Arctic sea ice. But somehow I've heard, I didn't document all the details of who and when, but recently that Arctic surface ice was increasing. What do you know about the Arctic sea ice?
Well, the Arctic sea ice is an important, it's like the, almost like the canary in the cage and the mine, is telling us something about rapid change in the far north. And what's happened with Arctic sea ice is there have been 2 really low years. I think one was, I'm trying to remember, one was 2007 or something, and then the other was just last year. And so if you look at 2007, you say, oh, gee, that was really low, and then why didn't it go further down? But again, that's the climate variability. If you look at it on a 10-year average, Arctic sea ice is on a straight line down. And so I don't know where the myth comes from that it recovered. There were several years after that low, which the sea ice extent was not as small. again, you hit another year, and it drops down again. So the minute you recognize that we should be dealing with climate, not weather, and not a single year, all of these series are just basically straight lines. And that's sort of what the models tend to predict. They're not perfect at it, and it looks reasonable. And so the changes have been sort of consistent. Whether you look at sea ice extent, you look at Greenland melting, you look at sea level rise, they all fit in together.
Now, I think I may have just found part of where the idea that Arctic sea ice was growing maybe came from Rush Limbaugh, who this Mother Jones piece says actually appears to have gotten confused over this, claiming recently on his show that Arctic ice was at a record extent before correcting himself and realizing that he meant Antarctica. But myth number three, growing Antarctic, or basically South Pole ice, undermines global warming concerns. What's your response to that one?
Very interesting. That one, I mean, the Antarctic sea ice is growing very slowly. It has, again, variability, but I think it's like a couple percent, it's about 2% per decade. It's not very much change compared to the Arctic. That was a very interesting statement, the myth, because I had I teach a class on this, and I just brought back the Summary for Policymakers and told my class to pick out the most important statements, and one of my students picked that one out, the Arctic sea ice. And so if you read the statement, I'm trying to remember, let me find the exact statement on Arctic sea ice, it's quite straightforward, not surprising, but let's see if I can find the exact point here. The average rate of ice loss, oh, that's the Antarctic ice sheet has increased. No, that's the wrong one. Sorry. I have to cut this. Let me find the sea ice extent. But there is a one that talks about Antarctic sea ice extent, and the student picked it out exactly for what you described and said, see, this proves that global warming is all wrong. I looked down and said, well, why do you think that? And unfortunately, this is a beginning student. He said, well, you know, we're doing all the emissions of greenhouse gases in the north, so the north should be warming and the south shouldn't be, so we have it all wrong. And I looked at it, and I said, well, yeah, you've had a course on the greenhouse gases and chemistry, and you have they're all well mixed, and the warming's uniform everywhere almost. And then he got very upset. So he was very upset about the sea ice. The Antarctic is a very difficult place to model, and if you look at them, there'll be somewhere in the report you'll find a picture of how the models project recent and near-term Antarctic sea ice. And the models are actually all over the place in Antarctica, but it's small change. So the changes are very small, but the models have difficulty predicting the extent of Antarctic sea ice. And that's because the Antarctic is surrounded by this huge circumpolar current. It is approximately, you know, you can think of it as being 3 kilometers deep of very cold water. And so the last place to warm on this planet is going to be Antarctica. It's in contact with very deep cold water. It's a huge reservoir of cold. And so even if we pump warm air down there, the ocean keeps bringing up immense amounts of cold water to counteract it. And so Antarctica will probably be the last place on the planet to really warm significantly, just because it's protected environment and the fact that it's surrounded by a very deep ocean of very cold water.
This is Tom Clammer, and we've been listening this morning to Professor Michael J. Prather. Professor Prather has undergraduate degrees in mathematics at Yale and in physics at Merton and Oxford. He has a doctorate in astronomy and astrophysics from Yale and is an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change lead author. Let's get right back to it. Myth number four in this four myths you'll be hearing in connection with the release of your report: global warming won't be a big deal. It might even be good for you. One recent version of this was articulated by British science writer Matt Ridley, who argued in the Wall Street Journal that the leaked IPCC report dials back the alarm on global warming. Your response to that one?
Wow. I don't know where you would get that from it. The IPCC report has sort of two pieces of hardcore science in it, one of which is understanding the observed climate change to date, how large scale is it, how small scale is it, different regions, and how well do we understand it? The second part is, given different future scenarios for growth of greenhouse gases and economies and societal issues and, you know, what our behavior is for greenhouse gases, it examines the future. And it's not that different from the scenario, from the report 7 years ago. The biggest difference is getting a little more detail on the projected future and really solidifying the consistency of, you know, what we see and what we understand. Do we understand climate change? Do we understand the variability in it? How well do we think the models predict it? And so on. Both of those are getting tighter and tighter. And so I'm surprised that that one would come out. I didn't see, if I were to compare this to the last report, which I was lead author on also, I don't see any way that it ramps it down at all. And so I can't figure out where that one would have come from. Now, let's talk about leaking. This is hilarious, you know. Secret report leaked, okay?
Right.
This report is being written over 4 years. Okay, it starts 4 years. And after 2 years, you start seeing a report that's more coherent and put together in the chapters, whatever. It goes out for review 3 times. And so the governments get it. All the governments get copies for review. Any scientist who wants to be an expert, whether they are an expert or not, can register and claim they are and review it. And so it's not exactly a secret report at all. As a matter of fact, it's probably one of the more public reports that's ever published. Okay. The issue that's sensitive is what the summary will say, because the summary will be rewritten by the governments in that week in Stockholm. And so what you're getting is the scientists' first draft coming into it, and then the governments read it, think about it, and they say, well, given the science you've done, here's what we think is the most important part. And so that is still under deliberation, if you want to think of it that way. So, but the facts that came out never change. I mean, once the chapters start getting written up, we're reviewing published science. And so usually the facts don't change much, but the interpretation or what governments might think is the most important thing to bring to their minister might change. And so it's very strange. I could not figure out why the leaked one shows we have less problem with climate change. But I don't know what they were comparing it with.
Yeah, I was very, very determined to perhaps see of it what they want to see. But
I mean, there's one famous line in this one that this is a very obscure point, okay? It's called the climate sensitivity. And the climate sensitivity is a technical value that is used to compare models. And models run for future climate, and so in order to compare different models, they were always done with a doubled CO2. Because that way they would say, if you doubled CO2 from now, what would you get for climate change? And then they could compare the different models across the climate model. Now, this was done initially in 1979 for a U.S. National Academy report led by Jules Charney, and there are only 3 climate models in the world, okay? And they all doubled CO2, and they got answers like 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Celsius, and 4.5. And so the initial report said, well, we think the answer is between 1.5 and 4.5 if we double CO2. And so this is the one thing that people have tried over and over again to try to keep that measure going. And the new report does it. It reports on again. And what's changed is they admitted that maybe the 1.5, there's a small chance it could get down to 1 degree. But that's not the best value, nor is it, you know, it's like recognizing that there may be higher uncertainty. And so the climate sensitivity in this report, which is based on a lot of publications, now says, gee, it could be, you know, we think it's 1.5, you know, sort of the numbers are still 1.5 to 4.5, but there's a chance it's down to 1 and a chance it's as high as 6. Well, as high as 6 is like an unlivable planet. Down to 1 would be great, because that means we do have less worries about impending climate change. But again, the likelihood is very small on that. But they were going out to like 5 percentile. So they were looking at very small probability to say, well, it could be down at 1. And I think that's maybe what they grabbed onto, was the fact that the uncertainty assessment became more hard-nosed and said, well, what are the small unlikelihoods for this number? And so they said, we're reducing the predicted warming.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, in terms of expectations, I would say no. In terms of the small tail ends of the statistics, one of them got, they both, you know, went in different directions. And I think that may be the misinterpretation that we should now take it as it's much less. But the current best numbers haven't changed, whereas the uncertainty edges have expanded.
Well, like I've said, this is all a little overwhelming for me as a layman, but shall we try to get to this 20-page report that you referenced?
Sure.
And maybe I should have asked you to earlier, but you are one of the authors of this, correct? What was your level of participation?
Okay, so I was a lead author on Chapter 11 of the underlying report, which was the chapter dealing with near-term climate change. So it was looking at climate change out to 2050. That was a new chapter in this report. It was put in specifically because if you look at the change out to 2050, it really does not depend on which scenario you follow. And there are various scenarios to say, oh, we're going to emit more or less CO2, we're going to emit more or less methane, okay, aerosol. There are all these scenarios for future societal economic behavior, okay, called socioeconomic pathways. But those come in and they say, well, gee, and that's sort of, you can say, well, that's a crystal ball. We and this climate assessment can't judge that crystal ball. You just give us ranges and we'll run them. For the range of everything we looked at, up to 2045, 2050, it really doesn't matter what path you take. Thereafter, it starts diverging rapidly. Okay, now, part of that has to do with the time scale it takes climate to respond, and part of it has to do with the time scale it takes energy systems to be adapted and changing. So even on the current scenario, we have a lot of infrastructure built in that can't change. So even if we make efforts to mitigate and do other things, as you see, the pledges countries were making to reduce CO2 emissions were scheduled for 2040, 2050. They can ramp down before that, but it still takes time. So we have effectively a period of the next 30 or 40 years, which is very interesting, and that's why I wanted to work on this chapter, which basically we should be able to make predictions for what to plan for that don't require a crystal ball in terms of people's behavior, but are based upon shifts in the statistics of weather and the statistics of climate. And this is an opportunity to say, you know, if we believe the models can do it, we better plan on it, you know, to adapt to it. And so the near term was doing that. That was the part I was very happy to work on. As the lead author on the chapter, we all contributed to the summary. We put our bullets in, we put our best pieces in from the chapter. And then I was among the 40 lead authors, invited to go to Stockholm to back up certain parts of the report and to present it to the governments. And so I had two or three sections, like two bullets here and one there, that I was up on the podium, that I had to support why we wrote it this way, and then what is the information from the chapter that backs it up. What the governments are allowed to do in Stockholm is to rewrite the summary in any way they want, provided all the information comes out of the chapters. They've reviewed the chapters, the scientists have reviewed the chapters, the chapters are 1,000 pages of references and detailed information, and that's where anything that is scientific or any factual or assessment or uncertainties get brought forward. And the governments basically pull stuff out of the chapters if they want to change things. Because they say, here's what you wrote, we think this is important, we would like to have it up front. And usually the scientists say, that's correct, if you want it up front, we'll put it up front. And so it's sort of the scientists are dealing with this, I won't use their Bible, it's like an encyclopedia that they've just written. And they're saying, what, you know, and the government's been looking through it asking, what are the key pieces of information? And that's sort of what happens at the plenary, is when the governments get comfortable with the science and the encyclopedia that they've been studying and say, here's our summary of it. Does this match yours? Is it scientifically correct?
Okay.
So that was my job in some sense. I had two or three bullets that I was supposed to be at the podium to justify why as scientists we'd written them this way. And then the government said, yes, we like it. And so on mine, for example, they said, could you reword it for a little better English? I said, yes, how do you want it? And they did. I said, fine. And that then went through. Other things were more political. There was certainly politics going on at that meeting, but usually not with a scientist. It's usually government versus government.
So this 20 terse pages you mentioned earlier, just make sure I've got the right thing here. I've got a 36-page PDF that includes charts and graphs and so forth that starts
correct.
Out 12th session of Working Group 1 summary for policymakers. Am I on the right
Yep, you're document? On the right page. So it says summary for policymakers at the top. I'm down there as a draft contributing author. somewhere in the pile of authors that put in pieces, okay?
Uh-huh.
And then we begin with, it says, you know, summary begins with introduction, observe climate change. You're right, it's, I keep thinking of it as 18 pages or so, but what happens, of course, is it's not typeset yet, and so it's fairly broadly laid out, and there are about 20 pages of text, and then the rest is figures and tables, which will then get embedded in the text at some point.
Right.
So it's not easy to read, because just when you want to see the figure, you have to jump to the end of the document.
Right. And then there's some explanation about, if I'm not getting mixed up with the other one, levels of certainty and
right.
methodology that kind of threw me off a little bit. But
Well... Scientists try to be very precise and say, I want to make sure exactly what they say was reproduced or whatever, so they get very technical.
Right.
And some of this has to survive, and so the governments have learned to live with some of the technical language, but that means it gets put in footnotes to explain exactly what was meant. Okay.
Sure.
And so rather than expanding the text forever, there are often keywords used, and so you will find boxes explaining things. For example, there's a box explaining the scenarios called representative concentration pathways. That's not new information, it's just reminding the governments what was in there. Okay. There are tables that pull information out of the deep part of the document that are in there, but then there are little notes everywhere that are to make it technically correct. So we said this, here's exactly what we meant, is the purpose of those. And one of the difficult things is quantifying uncertainty. And what we've seen in the last 20-some years since IPCC assessment started in 1990, my first assessment was 1995, was more careful use of uncertainty. And so now you will see numbers that say, for example, the global warming, the average surface temperature increase from 1850 to 1900 versus 2003 to 2012, okay, is 0.78, and then it has a bracket, 0.72 to 0.85 degrees C. That bracket, unless otherwise stated, a little footnote tells you, it's 90% confidence. So that says, I'm looking at, there's a 5% likelihood of being less than the bottom number and 5% being warmer than the top number. And that's our basic uncertainty estimate from the analysis. The data sets, pulling together, doing the fit, everything else. And so there's a lot more precision in this, and it still, and it makes it harder to read. I agree. It is not easy to read. This is not a summary for the public, unless the public is very interested and wants to read it hard. There are pieces in it readily accessible.
Right. Like there's these shaded boxes. Like the first one says, warming of the climate system is unequivocal, and since the 1950s, many of the observed changes are unprecedented over decades to millennia. The atmosphere and ocean have warmed. The amounts of snow and ice have diminished. Sea level has risen, and the concentration of greenhouse gases have increased. Now, I can sort of grasp the idea that you need more scientifically precise language, but these shaded boxes pretty much make sense to me.
Right. So they are regarded as the headlines. And if you collect all those headlines, some of them are more technical than others, but most of them are okay. So the one you read was a very important one. It's saying, what have we seen on the climate system? And the second sentence there says it's not just temperature. It's not just atmospheric temperature, which we've, global mean surface temperature has been traditional. It's ocean temperatures, it's snow and sea, so on. So that says it's really happening everywhere. And then you get down to smaller headline bullets. The one underneath it, for example, says each of the last three decades has been successively warmer at the Earth's surface than any preceding decade since 1850. So that says, is global warming continuing? Yes. Okay.
Okay. And as we were talking before we started recording, I mentioned, you know, water cooler talk at work that I used to hear, and you talk about any decade since 1850 and things like this, and people say, well, you know, we barely had good data, especially in more remote parts of the world, certainly not before 1850, and a lot of it not until the 20th century. How do you know things have been changing that much? How do you have good data to make those statements?
That's actually actually a very good question, and scientists should be prepared to answer that and try to make make it clear. The 1850s is probably the earliest that any one group has pulled together measurements made with thermometers, what we call the instrumental period. And other groups actually begin around 1860, 1880, doing the same data set, gathering what we can from surface temperatures, from ships and whatever. That's the period that we have reliable measurements that people think they can get almost a global mean out of. Okay, and so certain regions, if you look at like the Arctic and Antarctic, we don't have good data probably until 1920s or 30s. And so there is a range of this. And so then if you want to go back further, we have to deal with what's called proxy data. And proxy data means we had very few temperature measurements with the thermometer. We have measurements like lake sediments, or we have the carbon isotope in tree rings, which tells us temperature when the tree was growing. Some of these, and we have various, we can dig into the ground and measure the warmth going in. So there are various ways you can do it. Most of them tend to be land-based. Some will be ocean cores. But we don't really have a global mean. We have an evidence of climate variability in different regions, from like accumulation of the ice temperature in Greenland and Antarctica we have. But we don't have those everywhere. And so we have evidence of climate variability back before then, and it's a major piece of science and hard work to try to pull together a synthesis which gets to be at least northern hemisphere land. And so when you look at that second bullet, for example, it says in the northern hemisphere, this was likely, this last 30 years, 83 to 2012, was likely the warmest 30-year period in the last 1400. That really only applies to northern hemisphere and most likely land, where we can go back to other records. And then you can go back hundreds of thousands of years with ice cores and see the glacial and the ice ages, and we know the climate varied a lot. So, yes, we have been a period, climate has shifted a lot, and it's usually been driven by the sun and Earth orbit and by the greenhouse gases together. And that's our evidence we have for sort of the ice age driving climate. But we've moved beyond that range with current, and we haven't yet gotten the hot temperatures we've seen at times, but we're forcing it at a rate of change that's much faster than anything we've seen in the last, say, million years.
Last million years?
Yeah.
Wow.
We have almost a million years of ice core data. And the ice cores in Antarctica, give us an idea of temperature around that region, not global mean, and they give us the greenhouse gases. So I think we go back 800,000 years now, close to a million, and we can see the ice age cycle. We can see how much ice there was on land as an estimate. We can see what the temperature was around Antarctica. We can see what the greenhouse gases were. And we know the orbital mechanics of the Earth, its tilt and its distance from the sun fairly readily. And so we can put together a fairly reasonable sort of climate budget model which drives climate cycles during this period. And so that's fairly interesting. 110,000 years ago, the Earth was warmer than it is now. It had much less greenhouse gases, but it had the greenhouse gases for 1,000 years. We're in a period where if we keep our greenhouse gas concentrations for the next 1,000 years, we're going to be much warmer than that period because it takes time to heat up the climate. And so when we've looked at things like older periods where it has been warmer, a few degrees warmer than now, not much, but a couple, then we see that the greenhouse gases were much higher than they were over the last million years, and everything sort of worked together. We're in a period now where estimates are Greenland's going to melt no matter what we do almost, but it will take maybe 1,000 years. And that's a very big shift in terms of sea level and everything else. So most of the climate work has been worried about the next 50 to 100 years. But there are people looking at long-term issues, and the long-term thing, which is way beyond our lifetimes, beyond our political timescales and who knows what, is the order of 500 to 1,000 years. We are clearly pushing the planet to a very, very different world at that point, and we don't know who will be there, but we hope that they can find it habitable.
This is Tom Clemmer. You're listening to Tell Somebody, and we're talking to Professor Michael Prather, Professor of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine. We barely started to talk about this summary, but the time seems to be going quicker than I anticipated. So I wanted to ask a couple things like, do I understand correctly that even if we stopped putting CO2 into the atmosphere entirely tomorrow, which is You know, it'd be good if we could slow the increase, much less stop putting any in. That's not going to happen. But even if we could, that warming would continue for some time.
Correct. That's sort of a hypothetical one. If we could stop putting CO2 in tomorrow, which would be interesting, we will still continue to have some warming that's been built up. It's in the pipeline, if you want to think of it. Okay. The ability, of course, to stop CO2 emissions tomorrow gets down to the socioeconomic issues as well as, you know, energy and other issues. So I think looking at anything reasonable says we're actually going to continue to put CO2 in. The question is, can we turn it over? Can we actually, you know, reach a peak and start reversing it? That time scale means that we're probably looking at another 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, which would be, you know, 2 to 4 Fahrenheit. And that's on a global mean. If you look at places like Missouri, you know, we're looking at 4 to 5 degrees Celsius by end of century, which is almost 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's going to be a very hot center of the country where it's going to be even difficult to work outside.
Wow.
So that's one of the worst cases. If we could control it and, shall we say, reduce CO2 at some level according to some of the scenarios, you might get 1.5, 2 degrees Celsius, which looks like 2 to 3 Fahrenheit, which is still warm on average. It still means that the heat waves are then another 3 degrees warmer. There's less frost. Okay. And then for the middle of the U.S., the precipitation, the rainfall doesn't seem to change too much. It's within 10% change. But I think the temperature changes are really going to be quite severe for the middle of the U.S.
Wow. And tell me if I'm getting out of your area of expertise, but I have this idea. It seems like some people, most of the people I'm in contact with don't seem to be that concerned. It doesn't seem to be a front burner issue with them, and they're dealing with all their day-to-day challenges. But there also seems to be a sense that, well, science will take care of this. There'll be some technology to undo this. Don't worry about it. But aren't there also some things that it's like there'll be tipping points, or like if you're pulling on a rubber band, if you snapped a rubber band, when you stop pulling on it, it's not going to go back to where it was before, and this could change ocean currents like the Gulf Stream warming Europe.
Right.
Any thoughts on that sort of thing?
It's like snapping a rubber band and having to get your knuckle on the way back, yes. So there are, you know, in some sense, why do we care about climate change? I'll be fair, you know, on a current day-to-day basis for family and other issues, climate change is one of those things, but there are far more urgent things, you know, things about, you know, what's the government shutdown doing to businesses near the national parks is far more urgent to be taken care of by those businesses than climate change. We'll have to worry about our own economy and our own society a lot. But this is the kind of thing it's like a freight train. It's slowly moving. We can have the ability to predict it. We sort of see it coming. We don't know enough to predict the details exactly on what's going to happen in a given region or a given area alone, but we see the sort of global trend and the shift in climate. And you know it's going to happen, and we know it's going to be difficult to stop. And so the question is it the most important now? No, but it's starting to accumulate. The damage to climate will start building up. And so at some point, you've got to decide whether you can get your stalled car off the tracks or what you're going to do about it, still within the domain that you've got to have your own development, your own economic status. People are going to want to live a good life, and that needs to be done. And then the question is, how do you prepare for something that's going to start building up and accumulating, and sooner or later you'll not see little bits of climate change but larger bits. And so what is it that we can do about it? Well, we can reduce emissions now slowly and start planning for it. We can't shut them off immediately, there's no question, but we can certainly plan on reducing them. Or we can do what people call geoengineering, and that is that, you know, there's a great cartoon from one of my favorite cartoon strips, Bizarro, where the man says to his young daughter, would you stop worrying about the climate and just, you know, do the things. You know, you're supposed to figure out how to get us out of this. You know, you will solve all this with miracles in the future. Yeah. And so I think the answer is, yeah, but you're digging a really big hole. The freight train is large and moving. The longer it runs, you know, if you don't apply the brakes early, it's going to be harder to stop. And I think geoengineering has had several proposals, one of which was carbon capture. So you pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. That would be great if we can do it. The New York Times had an article over the weekend that said there were 73 worldwide efforts to do this. They're now only 62 and they're dropping. People just aren't bothering. It's too expensive and difficult. It would be very good if it worked. It's quite important. The Norwegians were supposed to be doing it on offshore oil wells. They were trying to capture the CO2. They'd burn the gas for the energy on the oil wells on the North Sea. They're going to pump it down as liquid CO2 back into the mine, back into their place where they drilled. They've given up on it. And the Norwegians are one of the greener economies efforts to do this right. If they've given up, it's sort of depressing. There are other people who say, oh, we'll put mirrors in space and splatter the sulfate. You know, we'll put sulfate aerosols all through the stratosphere and we'll reflect the sunlight and cool the planet. That sounds good, and it does work for volcanoes, but the point is, number one, is you have to keep it up every day because the stuff falls out. Greenhouse gases last 50 to 100 years. The stuff that we put in the stratosphere, we have to do it every year. And the other problem is it does other weird things to climate. It creates acid rain in the upper troposphere. We have to figure out what happens to that. It changes the evaporation and weather patterns. And so what we're doing is weather modification on a large scale, and you sort of wonder whether, you know, you want countries doing it for their own benefit or not, or how it affects different things. I would say we don't understand enough to predict, except we know that other things happen when you do these geoengineering. And we're trying to figure out what those other things are. You know, are you digging a different hole?
Yeah, laws of unintended consequences.
Right. Exactly that. And that's the part where we're not quite sure what's happening. That's what the summary, the Summary for Policymakers has a geoengineering bullet at the end, as you found, that says, you know, unintended consequences are we're uncertain. We really don't know what they are. And the other one it says is that we don't even know that we have demonstrated the technological capability to do this on a large scale.
Yeah.
So, again, it's an open-ended issue. It would be great if it solved the problems. People are still investigating it because it might be a stopgap at a certain point to cool the planet a bit while we get things under control or are able to deal with climate change. So you don't want to rule this out. But as a long-term solution, it seems like not an obvious one. Not something I would bet on. And the other thing is you're dumping it all on your great-grandchildren and saying, you guys solve it. We'll put $100 in the bank. That's the other argument. Put $100 in the bank, and we go on doing what we want. And then by the time our grandchildren have that $100, they will have a lot of money and a lot of technology, and they will solve the problem. And I think the answer is I hope they do, and I hope they have a lot of money, and I hope they live as well as we do. But dumping a problem on them seems to be a little unfair because it may be, you know, a larger gorilla at that point than we have now.
Indeed. Well, Professor Prather, seems like I just barely got started with some of what I wanted to ask you, but the clock is winding down. Any quick final thoughts you want to leave with our listeners before I let you go?
Well, as I said, I think climate change is something that on a day-to-day basis, we don't need to think about it. It's a long-term thing. It's a problem for our children, especially our grandchildren. And I think we have enough knowledge to start planning for it, both some of the climate change that's going to happen no matter what, and planning for the fact that maybe 50 to 100 years from now, we might not want to be pushing the planet this far. So I think there is enough evidence to show it. There's enough evidence to act. But we have to have political will, and I think political will comes from the people because we elect the representatives. Let's face it, it's our choice. Okay, so the government won't act. The government acts based upon how we vote and put them in. So I think it's political people. It has to come from people listening to your radio show. It has to come from people talking about the water cooler and saying, is this a future we don't want to head to?
Okay, well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that, but Michael J. Prather, Professor of Earth System Science at UC Irvine, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Tom, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you this morning, and I hope your listeners find this interesting, and if they should, they should go pester their scientists.
Right on. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody, and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.